my strategy, and it's sort of been this way every time I've had to do one of these turnarounds. You put your head down, you put one foot in front of the other, you try not to be too distracted by the noise and the dust in the air and the Sturm und Drang. You set your course, and when you get there, then people say, oh, okay, that problem's fixed, and they move on.
Up next on Long Story Short, more conversation with University of Hawaii Manoa alumnus and Citigroup chairman, Richard Parsons.
Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox, produced with Sony Technology, is Hawaii's first weekly television program produced and broadcast in HD. High definition, it's in Sony's DNA.
Welcome to part two of our conversation with Citigroup Chairman Richard Parsons, recorded in April 2009. Awarded the 2009 Dan and Maggie Inoue Distinguished Chair in Democratic Ideals, Parsons took a break from his demanding new job in a global financial crisis to share with local students. Parsons is a native New Yorker who majored in history at the UH Manoa, earned a law degree at the Union University's Albany Law School, and was hired as assistant counsel to then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller. We pick up Richard Parsons' story with his first step from the law into the financial sector. In 1988, he was named chief operating officer of the Dime Savings Bank of New York. Of all people to question his qualifications, his own children.
I had been representing this bank as a lawyer for a number of years, and I'd gotten very close to the then chairman. And he had a plan to retire in a couple of years. And people get very proprietary about their banks. And so this was like his baby. And he was not happy with the internal candidates to whom he could hand over the baton when he was ready to go. And so he recruited me because he believed in me. And I went home after this was all done, and I announced this to my children, my three children, at dinner. I said, well, you know, you're going to hear about this anyway, so I just want you to know that on Monday I'm leaving the law firm, and I'm going to the Diamonds, the president of the bank. At which point, both my daughters dropped their silverware, and the oldest one, whose name is Leslie, and the cutest one, she looked at me and she said, what do you know about banking? And the other, youngest one, who was then about 10, said, yeah, and you don't know anything about banking, and you can't just start as president, you have to start as like a teller. So they got all over me, they climbed all over me, until they found out that their mother was on board. And if mom was okay with it, then it probably was okay.
Mom must know something.
That's exactly right. They looked, you know, has he talked to you about this? They said to their mother. Once she said it was okay, then it was okay.
But you weren't being handed this gilded present. Your bank, your savings and loan was millions in the red.
Well, it turned not when I accepted the job, but it turned out that I went to the Dime in the middle of '88, and by the end of '88, beginning of '89, the thrift crisis was on full time, and we, as one of the biggest thrifts in America. We had our share of problems. It was a barn burner for a number of years, but we made it.
And you did turn it around.
Yeah, we did.
But you did get out of the financial institution business at that point.
Yeah, I was chairman and CEO of the bank from '90 to '95, and in that time I had gone on the board of Time Warner when. The old Time Inc. merged with Warner Communications. They took a dozen people from the old Time board and a dozen people from the Warner Communications board, and in those days it was thought to be proper to have an odd number in case you ever had a tie or something like that. So I was the first director brought in by the newly merged company, and I was on that board for 4 years when the guy who succeeded Steve Ross, his name was Jerry Levin, was looking for a president, and he asked me if I wanted to come over and be the president of the company. And I thought about it, because we had just turned the Dime around. We were really flying. We had done a big merger, and we were looking at doing some other things. And we were really on a path to become maybe the largest consumer bank in the city, including all the big commercials. But the Dime was, in the financial services sector, which is interesting, and important, but maybe not as much fun as some other areas. But more importantly, it was a regional bank. It was New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. And Time Warner was a global company, and I always had an interest in sort of global things. And so I did. And I didn't know anything about media and entertainment either at the time.
When you and Steve Case were both at the top of Time Warner, people here were very proud, and we figured, oh, it must be the Hawaii connection.
Absolutely. It was a Hawaiian thing, right?
Was it?
Well, no, not really. It was serendipity. But we came together more because of the merger of AOL and Time Warner. And then working together as colleagues for a number of years.
And not always the friendliest of colleagues?
I wouldn't say, you know, we were always sort of friendly, but we butted heads quite a bit. When Steve was chairman of the company and I was the CEO, you know, he and I came from different places. You know, Steve was a new media guy, and I was a sort of old media guy. And while we saw the big picture, perhaps similarly, how to get from where we were to where we wanted to go, we had different points of view.
And that was uncharted territory.
True, and that's really where you can have different points of view. I mean, if the path is clear or has been blazed before, it's relatively easy to pick up the markers. But when you don't know and you're trying to make it up as you go along, that's when people can come out in very different places. And Steve, you know, Steve is an entrepreneur par excellence. You know, he built a hell of a company, and he did it out of vision, courage, and determination. I'm much less an entrepreneur and more what I call a professional manager. You know, Steve took a small and hardy band and kind of took them through the woods to a new place and created a new business. But at some point in time, a thing becomes very large and very institutional, and you can't run it the same way out of your sort of hip pocket, so to speak. You have to put in structures and process and procedures, and to some extent some bureaucracy if you're going to run a company that's got 100,000 employees scattered all around the world. And so a lot of our differences sprung up out of how do you manage this now, not small group of insurgents, but large group of, you know, sort of entrenched defenders of the status quo. And I think at a point in time, Steve realized that he got more enjoyment out of and was better suited for the entrepreneurial role. So he left and went back. He created something called Revolution Companies now, and he's off starting new companies again and doing what he's really quite good at, which is being an entrepreneur.
Parsons had stepped down as CEO of Time Warner in 2007 and as Time Warner's chairman in late 2008. He made plans to enjoy the wine produced by his vineyard in Italy and contemplate what to do next with his life. But the global financial crisis intervened, and in February 2009, he was prevailed upon to become chairman of the beleaguered financial giant, Citigroup.
Reluctantly, I concluded some time ago that I was actually pretty good at dealing with crisis management, I'll call it. Companies in difficulty, because it's to some extent exhilarating, and it suits my personal style. Things for me sort of, it's almost like time slows down. I don't get panicked, and I can get focused on, all right, what needs to be fixed. It's like, you know, if the boat is sinking, you need to get everybody down to where the hole is and plug that hole up.
You like really high stakes,
right? As opposed to worrying about what tonight's menu is in the captain's dining room. It does. It concentrates your mind, and it yields to problem solving, and I'm a good problem solver.
Someone who knows you well says you do very well in that place where government and business meet. Mm-hmm. And in this case, Citigroup has had, what, two bailouts already by the government?
Well, bailout is a somewhat elusive term, but three to be specific. I mean, Citi got the original $25 billion and the original sort of injection of TARP monies into, I think, the top nine banks in America. And then we got another 20 billion, and we have a an insurance program that wraps around some of the bad assets on the balance sheet. So the city's been a big beneficiary of government assistance, although it's important for people to know that this isn't, you know, it's not like somebody just gave you the money. These are investments, and assuming we get this thing turned around, which I believe we will, the government will get its money back, and the taxpayers will get their money back with a very healthy return. There are assets on the books, which we refer to as the sort of legacy assets, the old assets, that need to be worked out. But underneath the current sort of clouds and turmoil surrounding what's it going to cost you to work out of the legacy assets, the basic franchise is still strong and viable. Citi is the most globally embedded bank in the world. It's got the biggest and strongest international franchise of any bank in the world. It's got great brand, good people, and terrific positioning. And so I think, you know, we've got a challenge of working through all those legacy assets and, you know, absorbing whatever that costs us and putting that behind us. But going forward, it's still a very strong, vibrant, and highly profitable bank.
And you like the idea of the problem solving.
Yeah, I do. It keeps you focused.
And you do your problem solving with a lot of connections in government, both Republican and Democratic administrations. You have had friends and dealings with, close dealings with.
Yeah, I think I've worked for, in one way, shape, or form, every president from Ford on, except for Jimmy Carter, who I didn't work for. But I've worked for Reagan and Bush 41, as he was known, George Herbert Walker Bush, and Bill Clinton, and Bush 43, George W. Bush.
And you were a transition member of the Obama cabinet in the making?
Mm-hmm.
You switched along the way, Republican and Democrat.
No, I never switched. I am what I am. But for example, once Mr. Obama became the president-elect, I mean, he's going to be the president. It doesn't matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat or an independent. He is going to be the next president of the United States. And so if you have an ability to make a contribution, and he certainly was reaching out for people, not just from the other side of the aisle, but from business, I was privileged to be able to participate.
And you haven't agreed with him along the way?
I agree with a lot of what he's doing. I haven't agreed with everything, but I don't agree with everything anybody says.
Former senior government regulator and author William Black makes a case that greed and incompetence are to blame for the financial collapse that hit hard starting in 2008. Who does Richard Parsons believe should be held accountable for the collapse?
And there are a lot of people around who want to sort of simplify this whole thing so that we can identify a villain and then, you know, feel better after we drag the villains out into the public square and execute them. And then somehow things will be better. But it's actually a far more complicated problem than that. You know, it reminds me of the old Walt Kelly line in the cartoon Pogo, you know, we have met the enemy and he is us. Everybody bears some part of the blame here. Everybody was a part of it, starting with the Congress, which encouraged what is now looked at as sort of irresponsible lending, the governmental-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, which sort of reduced underwriting standards, the banks, which made loans based on a notion that somehow if real property prices kept going up, you didn't have to have such a strong borrower, the real property would take you out of it, to people who came in and borrowed money to buy houses they couldn't afford or to put home equity loans on their existing houses so they could take their equity out and buy cars or boats or, you know, jewelry. I mean, America participated in this inflation of this balloon that's just popped, and the way we're going to have to get out of it is all of those things are going to have to kind of revert to the norm, and it's not going to be by sort of finding a few people and saying, well, it's all your fault, you guys did this to us, and we're going to extract our pound of vengeance, or
The George W. Bush administration deregulated much of this. What kind of regulation do you think now needs to be instituted?
You know, that's, you know, you put your finger on one of the causative factors, but only one. There are a number. The regulatory establishment failed to anticipate and regulate certain things that turned out to be really systemically very important. And so I think that that kind of new vitality is going to have to be breathed into that sector. And from a different perspective, in other words, one of the reasons that the government is working furiously to prop up the banks is because you can't get the economy started again unless the banks do their job. Banks are, in a free market economy, banks are sitting next to the heartbeat of the nation. If banks don't intermediate, if they don't collect deposits from places where people who have excess funds can put their money into a bank, aggregate them, and then lend them out in the form of credit to people who are trying to build businesses, keep businesses going, send their kids to school, buy houses, do all the things that you need credit for, the economy's just gonna sort of sit at the bottom of the ocean. So they need the banks functioning and functioning properly. And there's this whole notion of sort of too big to fail or systemic risk. If something is so significant to the system that if it goes down, it pulls the system down with it, well then almost by definition, that needs to have some regulatory purview put on it. It needs to be under some regulatory microscope or telescope so that you understand how things that are systemically important are contributing or detracting from the system. And we had holes in our net. We had people doing things, there's things called credit default swap, where companies like AIG, much in the news now, were essentially insuring financial instruments into the hundreds of billions, indeed trillions of dollars in nominal value worth, and nobody was looking at it. Nobody was aware of how much of this stuff there was, who it was being given to, what it was based on. And now, why is the government in bailing out AIG? Because if they let that go down, it's a threat to the entire financial system. And if the entire financial system goes down, then we have zero chance of reviving the economy.
So it's really hard to do a soundbite explaining what's happened, and people are very suspicious, and they look at now you're the face of a huge corporation that's had, as you say, three bailouts. So what's your strategy?
I got to stabilize the balance sheet. In other words, make it clear that we have enough capital to function like a bank is supposed to function, and that we're not going to be upended or turned upside down because the losses that are embedded in the portfolio are greater than the amount of capital we have to sustain those losses. That's number one. Number two, we've got to work our way through those bad assets as quickly and cost effectively as we can. So you keep the expenses down, but you move the stuff out so you can make room for good assets. And then three, you got to keep the rest of the people focused on driving the good business forward. Because you can't take the entire focus and sort of say, we've got to clean up the legacy assets and clean up the past assets. You know, it's a fast-moving world. It's a dynamic world. We need to be a part of it, and we need to generate revenues through the good parts of the bank that'll help offset some of the losses on the bad part.
So how much do you owe the government with these three bailouts?
The government has invested $45 billion in Citi. They own, as a result of that investment, some common stock and some preferred stock. And as I said, we get this thing right, which I think we will, they will get their money back plus a return. The other thing that the government did was the government essentially sold us an insurance policy around $300 billion of bad assets. And the way that works is they say, well, we'll insure that, you know, there's a deductible, fairly substantial deductible, almost $40 billion. And everything under that, we'll take 90% of the losses, for which we pay the government $7 billion. So it's not as if someone has just kind of lent or given money to Citi. They've made an investment. They've sold us an insurance policy.
And you know now the regulation is going to be, you're going to be looked at all the time.
Oh, that's for sure. There's no question about that. It's a lot of money. It's a lot of public money. And we're keenly aware of that and keenly focused on taking the bank to a place where we can repay that investment with, as I say, a good return.
You know, as we speak, this is the fourth month of the Obama administration, so the economy is still in turmoil. Would you make a projection? Can you tell us if you see any clear patches in the cloudy, stormy sky?
Yeah, interesting. I don't think we've bottomed out yet, but the current term that's in vogue is, you know, are there any green shoots out there? You know, like, and I think there are some. I think that we're starting to see housing bottom out. Starting. It's you know, housing prices are still falling, but buyers are back in the market. Money is once again available for home purchase. And that's a good sign, because the first thing that has to happen is that the housing market has to sort of stabilize and start back. And then the next thing that has to happen is the banks have to start lending again in a normal, not in a super or hyper, hyper sense, but they have to start in a routine and normalized sense. And I think when they finish this stress test that the government is now doing, and they're comfortable that they've capitalized the banks to the extent that they need to be, you'll see that start to happen late, let's call it third quarter, so end of summer. And my anticipation is that things will actually start to improve maybe as early as the fourth quarter this year.
During the period of growing excesses in the financial world, Richard Parsons served on Citigroup's board of directors while working as CEO of Time Warner. Didn't he see the financial collapse coming?
Well, first of all, you know, when you're running a company as big and as sort of dynamic and as complex and interesting as Time Warner, you don't have a lot of time to focus on somebody else's business, right? But you did say to yourself, I mean, we all did. I'm sure the average guy in the street said, you know, this is crazy, right? Housing prices are going up 10% a year. People are who you know have no ability to repay a loan or getting loans. You say, you know, this bubble's going to break at some point in time. But none of us sort of then sort of stop and say, well, it's my job to sort of, you know, be the town crier and run around town and sort of say, stop, you know, what are we doing? And in fact, what happens is, everybody becomes a market timer. People say, well, you know, there's money to be made over there, so I want to be there, and I'll get out right before it's too late. Well, mm-hmm. That never works quite.
So you're back as a top guy at a financial institution at a time when bonuses are a big point of contention.
And that's true, isn't it?
And you probably had to deal with that when you negotiated your deal this year.
That's true. You mean my deal for
your
me?
Your deal, yeah, bonuses. And how do you pay top talent at Citigroup?
My deal was easy because I said, thank you very much, but I don't need any more money.
So you're doing this for free?
Well, essentially, you know, I'm a board member, and all the board members get what board members get. But no, when they said, would you be chairman? You know, I have enough problems without taking that one on. The question of bonuses, however, is it's a complicated one because, you know, we live in a free market economy. We live in a market where people can evaluate their worth in the marketplace, right? And so let's take it out of the banks for a minute and put it into something everybody knows, sports. We have the highest paid player in baseball in New York City. His name is Alex Rodriguez, A-Rod. Now, is A-Rod really worth, I don't know, $25, $30 million a year? Who can say, except that if someone else is going to give him that and I want him, that's what I have to pay to get him, right? In the banking business, you have the same phenomenon. People can come and go, and they can work for whoever it is that they choose to work for. We don't have slavery in this country anymore. And so the situation with AIG was, you have literally hundreds of billions of dollars in these very complex CDS instruments that now need to be unwound and straightened out, and the losses need to be minimized. Not everybody can do that. I can't do that, for example. Guy that's running that camera probably can't do that. You may be able to, but you're extraordinarily talented. Those people have the option to go elsewhere and to work for whatever the marketplace will pay them. So they were given retention bonuses. They were said, look, if you stay with us and help us work through this problem, we will pay you at these levels, which were levels designed to be high enough to keep them from walking across the street and working for somebody else. That's the way our system works. Now, you know, did Wall Street get carried away with compensation? And are we at a point on the curve that when you now look at it, you say, holy mackerel, how did we get here? This is crazy. This is nuts. We have to change it. Yes, we're at that point. But you don't change it overnight, and you don't you don't change it without understanding that we live and work in a country where the marketplace is what determines the upper levels and the lower levels of compensation.
Citigroup Chairman Richard Parsons is a calm, tough player in the financial world. He relishes the opportunity to manage a crisis, and he hates to lose. So you may be surprised that it's his grandmother's words that come to mind when he's asked about his philosophy.
My grandmother once told me that that a good man needs to learn how to, two things. One is grace, the other is humility. And it's easier to be in touch with those two things when you fought the good fight but you've lost. Sometimes when you fight the good fight and you win, grace and humility don't leap to mind right away, and you can be a little boorish and egocentric. And those are unattractive qualities. I think you can lose with grace and with dignity and with a certain degree of humility if you know you tried your best.
Citigroup Chairman Richard Parsons says he is giving his best shot at this time in 2009 to getting the international financial conglomerate back on track. For Long Story Short and PBS Hawaii, I'm Leslie Wilcox. Ahui ho kako.
Long Story Short with Leslie Wilcox is produced in HD by PBS Hawaii with Sony Technology. High definition, it's in Sony's DNA.